This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from Dr. Penny Borenstein, San Luis Obispo County's public health officer.
Even though all of us in our lifetimes have never experienced anything like this, we have in public health planned for this exact scenario.
And a retired pilot shares her story about being one of the first women to be hired by a commercial airline.
As the years went on, it was the older people who were much more surprised to see a woman pilot. The younger people thought it was just normal.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 4th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Working Lunch is a new offering from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce aimed at keeping members connected. Each week, a conversation between the chamber's president and someone in our community doing interesting or innovative work is broadcast on Facebook Live. This week, we'll hear from Dr. Penny Borenstein, Public Health Director of San Luis Obispo County.
Welcome to the second edition of Working Lunch, the SLO Chamber's weekly series where we sit down with key community leaders. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today you'll get a peek behind the curtain into the woman of the hour, week, month, year, Dr. Penny Borenstein, the Public Health Director for SLO County. I assure you that if we had confetti cannons and a marching band, they would be deployed to welcome her. And I want to set the stage for our conversation today. We're not specifically going to talk about the current crisis, but I wanted to get to know the woman as the person who is leading our county through these difficult times. So thank you so much for being here, Penny.
Sure, thank you so much.
I wanted to start off at the beginning. Obviously, you got an MD, a doctor of medicine degree, but did you know in medical school that you wanted to be a public health director?
Yeah, so I was a completely odd duck in medical school. I was the rare student who went to school knowing what a master's of public health was and that I wanted one when I was completed with my medical studies. In fact, I was the first and perhaps to this day only medical student who did an elective rotation at the county health department. That's how geeky I was.
What was it that was that initial kind of draw?
I've always had interest in social justice. I was going to be a teacher through most of my school years because I wanted to do it better than many of my teachers. I liked science. I liked math. I was not pre-med in undergraduate school, but all of those things kind of came together for me of wanting to do something important for my community and apply the areas in which I felt I was pretty good at. And for me, that was addressing the community's health.
I'll say I've spent 20 years in local government and certainly have seen all of the recommendations and guidelines coming out of the public health director, no matter which county I was in. But, you know, it's really interesting to me at this point to see certain segments of our community elevated to that hero status for the first time. You know, people who work in the healthcare system, epidemiologists, and especially our grocery store workers and agricultural laborers. Maybe we'll see the first Dr. Fauci and Dr. Penny Borenstein this Halloween. And I was just shown a line of toys that Mattel is launching dedicated to those frontline workers. You know, how does this newfound recognition feel?
So I have to say, it's been absolutely surreal. Public health has always done its work in the shadows. And when we're doing a really good job, no one knows that we exist, right? So everything runs smoothly at restaurants. We do home visits for high-risk parents. We give immunizations. We give health education messages. And if all of that takes hold, there are no problems in a perfect world, and we operate behind the scenes. And I've always enjoyed that, except for budget time. So it's been absolutely incredible. And in fact, mind-blowing the amount of kudos that I personally have gotten. Awareness from the community about what public health is and what we do, at least in this one regard, with respect to communicable disease control. I hope that we will not need to do this again anytime soon or ever in a lifetime, but hopefully it is creating a level of awareness about the importance of public health.
How has the transition to being SLO famous been for you?
I must say it's been super humbling and nerve-wracking to a degree. I wake up every day wondering what I'm going to do right today, but I also wonder what I'm going to do wrong today and how many people I'm going to piss off, because it is very weighty to have the community's well-being in my hands, not just me alone. I've got a really amazing team that I'm working with, really smart people at every level. So at the local level, state level, we're less engaged in the federal level, but there's a lot of people that are just doing really smart work and working incredible hours and smartly and in a committed way. I think half the time my name keeps getting mentioned as a way for everyone to hide behind that cloak. But it is a recognition that this is a public health event and we need public health leadership. And so I and a whole army of public health leaders across the country and the state and here on my team are just really trying to do the best we can. And as I said at the outset of this comment, it's very humbling because I don't take any of the decisions we're making lightly. We know lives are at stake no matter what, whether it's the disease or the impacts of the mitigation measures that are having significant and real and lasting consequences on people. So it is something I think about all the time.
You talked about, again, a terrific team behind you. And not taking lightly decisions that you're making. And thank you on behalf of all of us who don't get to be in my spot to say it directly to you. If you could wave a wand and everyone would magically do one thing, what would you choose?
So I think what really jumps to mind is to ask people to not be judgmental at this time of great crisis and great stress. It is really easy for one person or one family or one business to look at the next and say, you don't understand what's going on for me, and this is the way it needs to go for my own sanity and salvation. Even using as an example mask wearing, I've gotten so much input on that. Why don't you make it mandatory? There are downsides, and there are people who probably shouldn't wear a mask, and there are children. There's lots of things that go into every one of these important decisions. And so what I would ask of everyone in our community, this is not a political comment, but is to be on everybody's side, because we are all in this together. I know that has become a bit of a pithy statement that you see on TV, you see in emails, but it is absolutely true. As this epidemic and event goes in our community, so goes all of our well-being together. And so I just really would ask that people not be quick to judge other people's circumstances and to really try to understand that everyone is doing the best we can to try to move forward in a smart and steady and helpful way.
I was reading some on social media which said there are going to be people who want to go out when the order's lifted. Be kind. There are going to be people who wanted to stay inside when the order is lifted. Be kind. I think what you just said there is so powerful. There's a lot of people with anxiety and fear of what's happening today. To not be judgmental about it is fabulous.
You're listening to a conversation between Dr. Penny Borenstein, head of San Luis Obispo County Public Health, and Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce.
Is there a certain public health icon that you were looking to or trying to channel right now? I mean, certainly, as we've said, we're not all familiar with the public health icon, so we'd love to hear kind of who's kind of motivating you or at least helping you figure this out.
Well, first of all, I want to tell folks that even though I, in my lifetime, all of us in our lifetimes have never experienced anything like this, we have in public health planned for this exact scenario for at least a decade, if not quite a bit longer. Planning is a totally different situation than actually living it. But we, you know, have had at the ready, what do you do in circumstances when you have to pull out the biggest public health measures like isolation, quarantine, stay-at-home orders, shelter at home? The word humbling comes to mind all the time. And so when you ask me, you know, who do I look to as the best voices or heroes in this, certainly Tony Fauci has been one of those voices, Dr. Deborah Brix as well. But Anthony Fauci's been at this for a very long time. And he's at a point in his career where he can say what he thinks. And I very much appreciate that. The other person that really comes to mind is Vince Covella, who is known for risk communication strategies. And much I was going to say much more important, but as important in tackling the disease is the communication that goes on between the public health leadership and the community, and vice versa. It has to go both ways. And so for those of you who are not familiar with Vince Covello's work, he has some books out there, but one of them I had read, I'm not remembering the name of, was sort of the 23 points of how best to communicate risk in any situation. I happen to know that Mayor Rudy Giuliani used him as a model when 9/11 happened. It is probably the most difficult thing to do in this sector of public health, communicating effectively about what the risks are, how bad they are, what they're not, how to get your mind around relative risk. He's definitely one of my heroes in this arena.
Do you see any health-related silver linings in what's happening right now?
So on a really pedestrian level, I made the joke early on, except for my budget, I went into the field of public health because I really believe that every dollar spent in that arena is really well spent. And we put an extraordinary amount of our GDP into health care, whereas public health only gets 3 cents on the dollar typically. So perhaps this begins to shift the balance or pivot us a little bit more toward an upstream approach, prevention, vaccination, screenings, testing, healthy living, all of those things that I have spent a career advocating and working toward that ultimately will land us as a society in places that I won't have to talk as much about the vulnerable population with all their comorbidities and disease that makes them more at risk for something like COVID-19. Of equal importance, or something that I've been thinking a lot about in this, is how everyone now is an infection control expert. And that's great. And that is really fabulous that all of the teaching over my career that I've tried to do in, you know, wash your hands and cough into your sleeve and be careful about everything that you're touching and how not to spread disease, et cetera. Hopefully this experience will leave everyone with some better understanding of how to prevent disease spread in general, so that when next flu season comes around, maybe we won't see quite as much influenza. When the norovirus outbreaks happen, maybe we can get it under control better. We're going to see some good outcomes from this.
I love your point there on washing your hands, and like, this may actually reduce influenza of other types after we get through this, because people have learned all of the things that we probably should have known for a very long time that folks in the health departments are telling us. This just really drove it home in a terrible way, but hopefully something people take to heart. Have you gotten a chance to speak with Dr. Fauci?
No. No, but a good friend of mine has a lineup of the cast for the movie. Who's going to play me and who's going to play Dr. Fauci. I hope I'm not being too comical, because I want to, you know, we do need to find some measure of levity in what has been a really serious set of circumstances and for a very long time. But I do find that if without maintaining humor, we're really lost. So I hope that I'm not offending anyone by making jokes.
Knowing this is how you work through these issues is comforting to me, I know. And I hope the folks listening, because it really talks about the person you are, taking things seriously. We can tell that. Speaking of which, is there been something that made you smile or laugh in the last weeks?
Oh my gosh, the number of memes are unbelievable. So I watched The Masked Singer with my daughter. That's what lets us unwind together.
Oh, that's hilarious. I just found it. I had been making fun of it for a long time. Like, I'm not watching this. This seems silly. And I started watching it, and I'm now hooked. My wife and I are hooked.
You're listening to a conversation between Dr. Penny Borenstein, head of San Luis Obispo County Public Health, and Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce.
What is the strongest part of the health department in SLO County, and what areas require more input or information or improvement?
Well, so a couple of things that are absolutely related to this event that come to mind immediately is we have this gem of a public health laboratory that I think was virtually unknown to folks before this event, maybe still unknown, but we have only a half a dozen people toiling away literally many a day, working well into the evening to make sure that the specimens that we're testing get done in a timely fashion. This particular laboratory is a BSL-3. That means Biosafety Lab 3. That means that we handle all manner of what we call select agents. So anthrax, ricin, smallpox, God forbid. And there are only two BSL-4s in the world. So we've got a pretty robust and really state-of-the-art laboratory within the public health department. Another area that comes to mind is our environmental health services. And I know probably I've got a lot of business folks on the call and they think, the health department's here. But I'd like to think, and I know that the leader of that unit, Liz Posebon, she takes a very helpful and technical support approach to the services that we provide in inspections and permitting. They have played a really big hand in the guidance that's to help businesses figure out how they're going to come back and provide services in an environment with a new perspective on the need to social distance, to maybe limit customers. So they have put an awful lot of energy and thoughtfulness into not just saying thou shalt, but really providing best practice kinds of guidelines. And that's another area that has been really strong within our department.
And are there more that you think we need to plug into and help?
An area that we tend to struggle with that's underfunded, misunderstood. We've got great people working in it, but it's our health promotion unit. So that's where we do a lot of things to try to help the community's health in general move to a better place. So that's our tobacco control program, our obesity prevention efforts, our oral health, injury prevention. Sometimes those areas are seen a little bit more as fluff, and I think they are quintessentially important to us being the healthiest community that we can be.
I think all of your divisions are going to start to see a lot more interest and hopefully support from government, from public, to make sure we're doing that when we get to those budget times. And hopefully your budget times will get a little easier now, unfortunately, due to this situation. Do you have a family? Do you have children? And if so, how does it affect you or not affect you in dealing with that?
Good question. So I have two children. They're both teenagers, but my son, who is he's almost turning 17, has significant special needs. So for all of you parents out there who are dealing with online education, multiply that tenfold with a child who can't really do virtual education as well. And it has been really an incredible struggle. My 14-year-old daughter has come through this like a champion. She's been extraordinarily helpful. I also have had the good fortune to actually fly my sister out from the hot spot of New York, where I grew up, if you couldn't tell from my accent or my demeanor. She has been an absolute lifesaver as I'm putting in 12, 15, sometimes longer hours in our emergency operations center and still finding the important time to really talk to my daughter, especially about the fact that we will get past this, that this is an absolute historic moment, that she will look back on it with some measure of fortitude built in. And again, I'm going to use that word humbling. My daughter has not once watched any of my media briefings. And so when I come home and sort of tell her what was up today, and I'm like, hey, did you catch it? My sister's watching it. And she's like, no, Mom. I'm like, okay. So
there's nothing like family to bring you back down to earth, right? Do you have some words of comfort or encouragement for people who are starting their families right now or giving birth in terms of what to expect or ideas for them to just how to keep plugging through?
I think the world has, and our community especially, has shown its best colors. If I were bringing a child into this community right now, I would feel not just the love of my new baby, but the love of the wraparound of the community that has really come together. Businesses that helped us build the alternate care site, lots of volunteers that we've recruited. 600 people answered the call of, you know, are you a medical or other type of volunteer available to give in this situation? The food bank has really stood up. So, I mean, there's so many examples. I know I'm just naming a few. Again, the grocers, the pharmacists, the farm workers. It has given me such joy and pride in our community to see how many people are just stepping up and to bring a child into that environment of there's so much goodness out there. It's a wonderful thing to see.
We're so appreciative you taking the time to chat this afternoon. Thank you, Penny, for being here. And thank you for all the incredible work you're doing.
And thank you so much, Jim. It's really been a pleasure to have a conversation.
That was Dr. Penny Borenstein, San Luis Obispo County's public health director, speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. For more Working Lunch conversations, go to slowchamber.org. In the 1970s, Captain Karen Kahn was one of the first female pilots hired to fly with a commercial airline. Now retired, she spends her time in Santa Barbara as a writer, speaker, and mentor. Contributor Beth Thornton talked with Captain Kahn about her distinguished career and her support for youth in aviation.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm speaking with Captain Karen Kahn. She was one of the first female pilots to fly with a commercial airline in the 1970s. Earlier this year, she received the FAA's highest honor, the Wright Brothers Master Pilot Award, for 50 years of excellence and expertise in the aviation field. Thank you for logging on to talk with me.
You're so welcome. It's nice to be here.
How did you get into flying?
I actually started out learning to fly because I had a friend who was a pilot, and I was working in the late 60s at a magazine in San Francisco, and my friend said, hey, if you're interested in airplanes, well, I'll take you out to the airport. So we went out to the airport in Marin County, north of San Francisco, and I took an introductory ride, which you can still do today because introductory rides are how most everybody starts. And I had nobody in my family who was interested in flying. Matter of fact, quite the contrary. My folks were very much against it. So with that, I started learning to fly and kept thinking to myself, gee, it would really be great to do something for a living that you love to do anyway, and, you know, maybe get paid for it. Because I had gone through college not particularly liking my political science major, mostly thinking there must be something else. So with that, I started learning to fly, loved it, kind of said, gee, you know, if I had known that I was passionate about flying, I would have gone to an aviation college. But at the time, I had no idea that they existed. So I started out learning, eventually figured out after I got my private license, which took me about 6-7 months. Every time I got some extra money, I would race off to the airport. I finally figured out that it was a really good plan if you could work at the airport, because that's basically where the action was. And if you were willing, you know, to tough it out, that's where you were going to meet the opportunities that might become available to you. So I got my private license in June of 1969, and subsequently, about 2 years later, I got my commercial license, which was available through more testing and skills once you had 250 hours of flight time. I then got an instrument rating, a multi-engine rating.
You were one of the very first women hired by Continental Airlines. How did you land that first job?
The first job, of course, is way before going to work for Continental Airlines in 1977. But it certainly was difficult in the 70s to get anybody interested in hiring women, although there were quite a number of them. And there is an association of women who went to work for the airlines as pilots in the 70s. Then they started an organization called the International Society of Women Airline Pilots. And in the early 1977, the airlines start to hire. So I was fortunate. I applied to Continental Airlines. I had a friend who was actually a United pilot who lived here in town. And he had said, hey, I hear Continental Airlines is hiring. So he said, I have to drive down to Los Angeles. Would you like to come along and we'll stop and get you an application? So we headed to Los Angeles, and I got out, went into the employment office, picked up the application, and I was headed out the door, and he was kind of standing at the door saying, where are you going? I said, oh, I've got my application. I can go home and fill it out. And he says, no, you don't understand. Airline applications, the timing is crucial. The sooner you get your application in, the sooner you get interviewed, the sooner you get hired, the less likely you are to get furloughed. So with that, I stayed there grumbling a bit because I didn't have all the information I really wanted to put on the application. And I would never recommend to somebody that they handwrite an application. But in this case, I did. And just as I was about to turn it in, I asked the woman who was running the desk, I said, I would like to make a copy of this application before I give it to you. And she says, oh, what job are you applying for? And I said, pilot. And then she said, how much flight time have you got? And I said, about 2,000 hours. And she says, oh, well, we don't have a copy machine here, but if you go down the street to the 7-Eleven, they have one. And when you come back, be sure you put your application in this pile, not that pile. Well, it turns out they'd had very few women apply with the proper credentials. And about 3-4 days later, I got a call from the head of employment asking me to come in for an interview. And that began a long series of various kinds of tests and trials. And eventually I was hired by Continental in July of that year. So that kind of started in May. And in July, I was hired. I was their fourth woman pilot.
Wow. And
I think now that we have done all the statistics, the Women Airline Pilots Organization has figured out that I think I was the 26th woman in the U.S. to be hired at a major airline. So with that, that's how it began. And the training to become a flight engineer on a Boeing 727, which is where everybody would start. You would be running all the systems, the air conditioning, the heating, the cooling, the fuel.
Mm-hmm. And up until then, you were flying smaller planes.
I was flying small planes, and I had never flown anything, never anything that large, because they were realistic in that they realized that, you know, a lot of people had no access to large airlines,
right,
to large airplanes. They did at that time take probably 60 to 70% of their pilots came from the military. Mm-hmm. So we had 16 people in my new hire class, and I think three of us were from general aviation who all came with the small airplane background.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm speaking with Captain Karen Kahn. She was one of the first female pilots to fly with a commercial airline in the 1970s.
And with so few women, what was the work environment like?
I remember some amusing things. I was the fourth woman hired, so I got a chance to talk to the third and the second, because, you know, we would kind of pass on some hints. But, you know, it's like every now and then we would have training that was done on weekends, but it turned out on weekends, the flight attendant wing, where the women's bathrooms were, was closed. So, okay. So I would get one of the guys to stand guard at the door to the men's room, and, you know, I'd use the men's room. And but I always felt that the pilots at Continental were very accepting. Well, they were neutral if they didn't know me. And, you know, that's all I asked. Give me a chance to show you what I can do. And so I was always very pleased that there was, you know, with a very few exceptions, any outright, you know, we don't want you here. And I've actually heard about it later of people saying, sit there, don't touch anything. So, and of course, as the years went on, it was the older people who were much more surprised to see a woman pilot. The younger people thought it was, you know, just normal.
Mm-hmm.
So every now and then you would get somebody not recognizing and not wanting to accept the fact that, I mean, I moved up to captain in 1988. And, you know, I would say, look at my sleeve. Can you count? There are 1, 2, 3, 4 stripes there. And they would be busily talking to the first officer who has three. And, you know, they were always identifying people like that, but it just didn't register that there should be a woman who was in command. So, you know, I think mostly it was letting them know we're all in this together and that we're all working together.
And what is the percentage breakdown now of women pilots?
It's still very small. It's around 6 or 7%. In the United States, where people have to apply to the airline with pretty much the experience they expect, it's not like some places in Europe, in Asia, where you can actually, if you pass the employment tests that have probably nothing to do with actual flying, and you go out and pay your own fees to get your private, commercial, and instrument ratings, and a lot of them come to the United States to get that training. When you go back to the airline, then they will pay to train you, because someone at that point has about 300 or 400 hours. As you heard in my story, you know, Continental wanted people who had at least 2,000 hours. So with that, you know, we have always had a different system in the United States. It's quite a bit harder for people starting out here, although these days there's an awful lot of scholarships available and encouragement that we didn't have in those days.
Well, that's a good transition into our conversation about mentoring young people. Tell us about your work with the nonprofit, A Different Point of View.
When Different Point of View started, I think in 2012, I know Lynn Houston, who started it, who was a retired SkyWest captain who worked and just very recently retired as public relations director of the airport. She just wanted to start this organization, and I thought it was a wonderful opportunity, because the real problem is, unless we kind of help the younger people move into our shoes, once all of us gray hairs are gone, who's going to fill the spots? And of course, what you'd like to do is pass on the word that you think is important. And she had an organization and she was working with small groups of young people and really instilling in them the values that she felt were necessary to succeed at anything, and using aviation as a catalyst. So, you know, I have talked to them in groups and gone to their events, participated in various activities, one which was one of the launches of one of the missiles at Vandenberg. We all went out there to watch one of the missiles go off from afar. But they've got a great supply of people here in town who have worked with them, and they also do have the very generous support of several of the flying schools. So they have been helping them as well. Through donations, they get the money to help them take the lessons after they've completed all of the ground training portions.
Just one tip, one piece of advice for getting where you want to go in life.
It would be proactive on your own behalf. Don't wait for it to happen to you. You go out and make it happen.
And that's very good advice from one of the first female commercial pilots. Captain Karen Kahn, thank you for talking with me.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
A Different Point of View is a nonprofit that teaches Santa Barbara area youth all aspects of aviation and, ultimately, how to fly a plane. Captain Karen Kahn is a mentor with the program. Beth Thornton spoke with Executive Director Ali Cortez to learn more.
My name is Ali Cortez. I'm the Executive Director of A Different Point of View. It's an organization that engages, inspires, and transforms youth using aviation as a launching pad. Not just how to fly a plane, but how to fly their life, how to really navigate their own life, how to make good choices, how to find positive relationships. We provide mentorship, life skill classes, career classes. We really try to, you know, support our youth in bridging all these life lessons that they need. And it's amazing what you can learn in being in a plane.
And how did the kids get involved?
Some students get to come by because a counselor, invited them to the program, either another mentor or word of mouth. Another youth had a great time and they're just bringing in their friends. Parents sometimes really find out about our organization and they know the value of a program that is designed with structure and also with care and provides, engaging activities that could lead to potential careers as well. So have organizations that we partner with here in Santa Barbara, like the Police Activities League. We also work with probation, other organizations with underserved youth that, you know, we want to open this opportunity for all our youth and for them to have the experience to see themselves in a whole different way.
Can you give us a brief history about how the organization started?
This agency is fueled by empowering women. Lynn Houston, she is an incredible leader here in our community. She was working for the airport. She's a retired airline pilot, a CFI, certified flight instructor, and she wanted to do more. And she knew that one untapped resource is the youth. She created a program called A Different Point of View in 2012. I stepped in as executive director just last year. But the way I started was I was a case manager for foster youth. And one of my first case jobs was this student who had her life together. She was in high school. She was getting good grades. She had a job at the airport. She was, you know, very polite, professional. And I was astounded. And I asked her, well, how do you do this? How are you so self-actualized already at 17? And she said, oh, Lynn Houston, and A Different Point of View.
And this is all happening at the Santa Barbara Airport.
This is happening at the Santa Barbara Airport, yes. We have three different programs. We have our Aviation Career Day program. And that's really like the big, you know, we take you on a whole tour of the airport, the tower, and then you get a flight lesson. So for a lot of these youth, they've never been on a plane. And this is their first time on a plane. And not only that, but flying it. And then we have these other programs too that are more mentorship, you know, where we bring in pilots to just mentor them. We have a CPR certification training by pilots, you know, engaging with mentors, flying drones. So we try to also bridge the whole world of aviation. There's the private sector, there's the airport sector, there's a general community of aviators. And we try to bridge that all together to just show these youth all these other different life skills.
How many kids have gone through the program?
600 youth since 2012.
How can people get in touch with you?
We have a lovely website, adifferentpointofview.org.
That was Allie Cortez from A Different Point of View. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
Correspondent Tom Wilmer speaks with Christine Johnson, Executive Director of the Central Coast Aquarium, to learn more about the future of that facility, as well as plans for a new incarnation of the Morro Bay Aquarium.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the waterfront in Morro Bay. Come along and join us as we visit with Christine Johnson, the Executive Director of the Central Coast Aquarium in Avila Beach. But here we are in Morro Bay, and there's a connection to your aquarium world with the demise of the old Morro Bay Aquarium and its rebirth. So you are up to your neck in alligators and sea otters.
Fortunately, not alligators.
Yeah.
But not yet, right? Not that we know of. So for 25 years, a passion project with Russ and Carol Kiesig, who were from San Diego area but became hoteliers here on the Central Coast.
In Avila,
yeah. They had Sycamore Mineral Springs. So the passion of Russ, his family, they were a fishing family, mostly taking folks out fishing for the day. So he was tied to the sea, even though he spent a lot of time in a hotel. Kind of a jack of all trades. He'd had many different careers. So just started to teach classes for free on Harford Pier.
Because he loved it so much.
Because he loved it, yeah. And then unfortunately for Avila, they had the oil disaster. But those funds, the remediation funds from UNICAL, were part of what built the current building that was opened in 2006. In Avila.
Mm-hmm. And that's the aquarium facility.
Correct.
And that's open to the public as well as pre-arranged school trips, right?
Exactly, yeah. But it hadn't been open to the public except for weekends until about 3 years ago. But just financially, no matter who's in the building, you're still caretaking for the fish and the wildlife, so you have to have 24/7 operation in terms of electricity and, you know, water and sewer costs high. So even a small place is expensive.
At some point, you were looped in to deal with the Morro Bay Aquarium before it closed, correct?
Correct. So, and not really connected necessarily at the time I first became aware of Central Coast Aquarium as a parent of a child visiting there. But then when I was on the Morro Bay City Council from 2012 to 2016, we dealt with the lease that was expiring here on the waterfront for the old Morro Bay Aquarium. At that time, the council's decision was to look for other options for that space, another aquarium style perhaps. And Central Coast Aquarium, they were the only entity that responded, so they began working with them. Fast forward about 6 years, then the opportunity to work at the Central Coast Aquarium came to me and interviewed for the job. And then part of that was sort of sorting out what we were going to do about Morro Bay from the Central Coast Aquarium's perspective. So working with the city and Cal Poly Center for Coastal Marine Sciences, really sitting down and figuring out what was possible here. So a few studies had to be done. We raised money twice for two different studies, and we were sort of ready to go perhaps with launching a capital campaign after about March 10, 2020, four or five days before our shutdown.
Right as you guys were getting under steam, then the whole world just goes sideways. And I understand that every one of you, you've all been basically laid off, and you're doing what you do from a volunteer status to keep the flow going.
Yes, that's true. We had a small team anyway at the Central Coast Aquarium, but as of the 16th of April, we've had to, what we're calling it, when it go into a temporary system shutdown. So we had to close up the building and had to release the marine animals because we're just not sure when we will have a situation where we have positive cash flow again through school programs, because now the schools have been closed. Field trips make up a giant part of our revenue in the spring, as does spring break travel, and then tourism for the summer, and then, of course, day camps. So we've basically lost every opportunity we have for our majority, 65% of our funding comes, you know, within about 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
And we've lost that.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So an interesting story about finding homes for your homeless sea otters and whatnot.
Well, we don't have marine mammals. I want to be really clear on that. So we do have invertebrates and lots of fish and a couple two-spot octopus and things like that. But yeah, we're not, in that way, we're very dissimilar to the Morro Bay Aquarium when we don't have marine mammals.
Got it.
And that's part of what we talked about through this planning for the Morro Bay project, was kind of this idea when we had a feasibility study that sort of laid some groundwork. We feel like Morro Bay would be kind of an aquarium without walls. We would have a lot of networking and partnerships with the local businesses that provide all kinds of tours on the water. You know, so maybe your ticket would be for a certain amount you get into the aquarium, and then you also get to go on, you know, a sunset cruise where you see the marine mammals close up.
Interesting. So to see the marine life, you go out and visit them.
Yes, that was the goal, yeah. Specifically for the larger marine animals. Right. Yeah, exactly. But then we would have a focus within the aquarium would be on the unique ecosystem that is the estuary. Mm-hmm. And what happens in the mudflats and how interesting seagrass truly, truly is, and eelgrass and things like that. So
interesting.
Yeah. Well, what we've done is we had the feasibility study for Morro Bay, and that was funds raised almost exclusively from people in the Estero Bay area. Then through that feasibility study, the city, Cal Poly, and Central Coast Aquarium agreed again to continue forward to the concept design phase, which is an architectural rendering of the exterior and interior of what a new aquarium would be. That process, we wanted to be very inclusive. So we spent a 2-day, they call it a planning charrette. So it's basically like a big intensive workshop for 2 days. And we brought together Central Coast Aquarium team, volunteers from the aquarium, as well as state parks, mm-hmm. and the National Estuary Program, along with city staff and Cal Poly. So we had a 2-day intensive meeting where we specifically talked about collaborating. For example, some aquariums have a focus on birds, especially seabirds. That's a focus here in Morro Bay, certainly, but we found out that the state parks is really going to get ready to invest in some exhibits dealing with seabirds. So why would we take that on, mm-hmm. if it's already happening, right? We've just talked about cross-programming and things that we could do collaboratively, but we are really intent to work with the National Estuary Program.
So going forward, I know it's all conceptual at this point, but vision. Walk us through, give us a visual of what we would see and experience when the Morro Bay Aquarium opens.
Sure. So we have, it's available on the city's website if people are interested. And seeing what the design, we worked with 10G Aquarium Design Systems, and they're from Carmel, and the partners in that firm have a lot of experience working in other aquariums throughout the U.S. and throughout the world, but they are really based in Carmel Valley, so they know the Monterey area very well, which means that translates to understanding who we are here, you know, on this part of the coast.
Do they have a connection with the Monterey Bay Aquarium?
They all began working there, mm-hmm. and they all met their spouses there. It was a really great story. Yeah. So, you know, in the early days of Monterey. Mm-hmm. So they understand what this coastline has to offer, and they appreciate the uniqueness of an estuary. Okay, so that's the one thing. So they helped us decide what would be in the interior. And then RRM Design Group, a local, mm-hmm. architecture firm, they were the ones who did the core and shell. So basically, it's on the same site as the former aquarium, but expanded into the parking lot area. That's part of the city's vision as to...
What happens in the former parking lot area?
Well, you basically get a bigger footprint for the overall, the first floor of the, mm-hmm. exhibit hall. So you walk in and you basically, it's as if you were entering, you know, the estuary as a marine animal. So there are, this is a fish hatchery here. It's a place of respite where animals come to rest when the ocean is wild and powerful, or to spawn or to give birth. So there's this idea that you come in and you go through the darkened spaces and you learn about the estuary itself. And then as you come through, you end up out to the open ocean, and you actually, in this part of the exhibit, you will go outdoors. It's enclosed so you can see from the outside. If you don't have to pay to get in to have this, mm-hmm. view of the outside. But when you're actually inside the aquarium, you would exit to the exterior part as if you were an animal exiting and entering from the estuary out to the open ocean and back and forth. So it's this idea of flow, just like the animals experience. Mm-hmm. So that was the first floor. And there would be over 20-plus exhibits, a lot of hands-on things. And then the second floor would be classrooms. Specifically, we would be having Cal Poly have many classes here, as well as other school student groups. And then we'd have a small administrative office, but then the ability to open up the entire second floor to take advantage of the rock views and the sand spit views, and to have groups gathering up there, either for our purposes, for education, or as a rental space for other events in the community. So maybe 125 people could gather up there, all wide open. So.
And the new incarnation, you're not going to have sea lions or sea otters.
No,
living
we're going to have a dock, mm-hmm. and the dock is a place where Cal Poly will have their research vessels, but also we're hoping that other harbor tour groups would be able to drop people off, pick people up at
our
dock.
Like the whale watch, for example.
Yeah, exactly. So we were hoping to coordinate and to collaborate, and we could do paddleboard trips early in the morning, kayaking, anything. We could also do walking tours down to check out the otters. We could work with, you know, state parks on their otter trailer.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Correspondent Tom Wilmer is speaking with Christine Johnson, Executive Director of the Central Coast Aquarium.
We are really hoping, now that we've narrowed it down to being an estuary-focused aquarium, which I don't know if it'll excite everybody, but this may be the first estuary-focused aquarium in the world. This is what our experts tell us, right? It's cool.
Yeah.
So having that close connection to the estuary program is really important. And part of it is, too, they do have funding for education. So exhibit design, we would work very closely with them on exhibit design, and maybe there would be some ways they could participate in that. So it's unique to Morro Bay, and it's the collaboration is always something that you see here on the waterfront, people collaborating all the time for success. And I think that's something that, you know, is kind of first and foremost. And we live with amazing resources all around us, too. You know, with the Maritime Museum being here and, you know, the Historical Society, there's just a lot that we can collaborate with to make an experience for either the visitor or the tourist a real full one, and really give people something to do. Perhaps, talking about tourism, you arrive on a Friday night, we could have, you know, some sort of a happy hour and a small education program with wine tasting on a Friday night, and then people can come back on a Saturday. So it's just, you know, and maybe do a Sunday morning paddle tour with one of our docents and, you know, learn about the invertebrates here, right, you know, under the water, under where we sit here on this dock, is teeming with life.
Yeah, right behind you, there's a sea otter and its baby. That's really cool.
Right. We're excited about the possibility. Right now, of course, our attention is turned toward Avila and reinvigorating Avila, rebuilding the collection there, kind of taking a little breather, though, and letting society sort itself out a bit.
Right. Right now, the here and now, these are strange days, and nobody quite knows how. It's like playing with mercury, you know. It's just, so optimist, pessimist, where are you at?
I think what's important in these times that are uncertain and a bit unstable is you can't lose your vision. You might have to project your vision a little further into the future, but you need vision, you need visionaries, you need people that can manage the current situation. And I think if you take a look at our Central Coast Aquarium world, that means respectfully, ethically, within permittable behavior. We were, you know, released many of our animals to the wild. We worked with Fish and Wildlife to do that. It's quite a big undertaking. You have to categorize every animal that you have, and then they give you parameters of where you can release them. So most of our animals who could be released to wild were released back into the Avila Bay area. Some had to go south of Point Conception.
Yeah, talk about that for a moment, because you had a high school down in Santa Barbara County.
Yes.
Who were real lifesavers for you.
Exactly. I don't think many people maybe in San Luis Obispo County know, but Lompoc, the high school there, Cabrillo High School, not to be confused with Cabrillo Aquarium, which is in San Pedro. Okay, it's the same name. But Cabrillo High School has an aquarium program for their students. And it's about the same size as the Avila Aquarium, quite honestly, maybe even a little bit bigger. And our designer that we worked with for Morro Bay just designed a new touch tank for them. So they were thrilled, really, to get a lot of our touch tank animals. So we have a relationship where we share a lot of animals, especially, you know, the moon jellies and things. So we called, and they brought two cars and a bunch of coolers and three people. And using proper social distancing, we're able to pack up a lot of the animals that could not be released to the wild, animals that just had been purchased when the initial aquarium opened in 2006. But, of course, they live a long time in captivity, right? But we really didn't feel confident releasing those animals to the wild. So they were able to adopt them, which was wonderful. And
your octopus.
They had their own two-spot octopus, so we returned those to Shell Beach, which is where they were from the, you know, the tide pools there. But they were able to take one of our sheephead, which, you know, our docents really do bond with the animals, and people think, how can you bond with, you know, a fish? But you can. So if anybody wants to visit Scarlet, the sheephead, she's there at the Cabrillo Aquarium at the high school whenever they can open up again for public visits. But we were really grateful for their effort to come. And then we're grateful to Fish and Wildlife, too, for permitting us to do that in a in about a 9-day frame of time, which is pretty quick, quick turnaround. Yeah. And then the two Garibaldis we had were released. We didn't know we could release them, but they're the beautiful, they're the California marine fish, right? The orange Garibaldi. So they were released south of Point Conception.
So going forward with dreams and visions, that all transmutes into funding and fundraising. Where are you going? What are your ideas for keeping that financial momentum going?
So, right, there are two projects, really. So the Morro Bay project, we'll just kind of start there. That's a little bit clearer. So we were able to raise in about 2 years, pretty under the radar, you know, just a little bit of networking to raise about $80,000 for the two studies. So that money has been raised and spent, and there's a little bit more permitting to get through with the city, but the Morro Bay project is really kind of out there, not quite shovel ready, but could be shovel ready quickly if there were to be large donors.
So it's real. It's totally predicated on underwriting.
If you had the funds, you could build the project.
Right.
Exactly.
But so that's...
So we don't have the funds, but that would be... was our next phase.
Looking forward, how are you going to get the funds?
Well, at this point, with the Morro Bay project, I think we'll just let it float out there, forgive the pun, and to just see when people are ready to think about funding large philanthropic projects like a marine science center. I think at this point, philanthropic focus really should be on the most critical needs in our county and elsewhere. So Morro Bay is nearly ready to go for a capital campaign as the tide turns,
right?
So it doesn't hurt anything to have a designed project ready to go.
Perfect.
That's where a vision is, right? So, someone comes in and they say, we want to revitalize Morro Bay. We know we took a big hit in 2020. What do we need to come back strong if something like this were to happen again? I mean, maybe not something of this magnitude, but there are ups and downs in our tourist economy here, no doubt. For Avila, we're taking a break, reassessing, developing a plan, a reopening plan for Avila and what it would take to rebuild to where we were. It'll be a longer, slower walk back to where we were when we shut down on the 15th of March. We won't get there right away, but, you know, we're hoping perhaps to be able to open in the spring of 2021 and developing the philanthropy needed for that. So that would be developing another group of donors who find that Avila Aquarium very special to their heart and to this community. So that's sort of what we're talking about now. If anyone would like more information about what we've talked about, the best way to reach me these days is really my cell phone. Just give me a call. So if I can give that number out, that would be great.
And probably a website would be...
Yeah, I would say definitely check the CentralCoastAquarium.com website for updates. Our social media page has slowed down a little because some of our part-time folks were better at that than others. So with everybody on hiatus, we haven't been as good on social media, I will confess. But certainly they can always get information at the website or by emailing info@CentralCoastAquarium.com or giving me a call at 805-305-3759.
Christine Johnson, Executive Director of Central Coast Aquarium. Thank you so much.
With people stuck at home, the value of an old-fashioned phone call has taken on a new meaning. KAZU's Erica Mahoney spotlights two Monterey County organizations who are making dozens of calls each day as a way to check in with people that they serve, all while facing their own struggles.
If you live in the city of Monterey, you may have received this voicemail recently.
I'm calling from the Monterey Sports Center. Even though our doors are closed, our staff is still here to serve you.
The Sports Center, library, and other services shut down in mid-March. These are places that senior citizens rely on for community. Sarah Zeal is the recreation coordinator at Shoals Park, the senior center.
I always tell my staff that we need to be welcoming and engaging with our customers, because we may be the one conversation that this person has in a day.
Those important conversations are still happening, even while everyone's at home. About a month and a half ago, the city of Monterey launched Operation Outreach. Around 12 staff members from the Sports Center, Library, and Senior Center are calling the city's most vulnerable populations, seniors and those at risk of COVID-19, to check in and offer resources. Sarah Zeal and her colleague at the Senior Center make between 60 and 80 calls each day.
People just need someone to talk to, and we do the best we can to talk them through any upset feelings or emotions that they're having and try and keep them as positive as we can.
These phone calls have also been a bright spot in Zeal's day, even as she's going through a hard time herself. The city of Monterey has proposed to lay off about 20% of its staff at the beginning of June.
You know, I am one of the people going through that process of potentially being laid off. So it is, you know, a scary time, but we are also keeping positive that we know this is something temporary.
The plan is to keep Operation Outreach going, despite the proposed layoffs. So far, the program has logged nearly 900 hours in phone calls. For Sharon Stugan, it's helped with loneliness. When the senior center closed, she said she had no one to talk to.
And then all of a sudden the phone calls would come in once a week or so, and it was very, very helpful to get me through these trying times, or help to get me through these trying times.
In Salinas, a nonprofit that provides housing, social living skills, and a wellness center for people with mental illness has created a similar program.
We have groups on meditation. We have groups on anger management.
The nonprofit is called Interim Inc. Katrina McFeeder is one of the program coordinators.
We have groups on nutrition. These groups provide peer support because it's peers that are leading these groups.
The idea for their new phone call program, called the Warm Line, had been floating around for years, but the coronavirus suddenly made it necessary.
The Warm Line is a way that we can call each day, or they can call in each day.
Some of their participants are homeless, so Interim bought them cell phones. The phone mentors, as McFeeder likes to call them, are already trained in communicating coping skills.
We're that friendly voice on the other end of the line asking how you're doing and what are some of your struggles right now, whether it be anxiety, whether it be just fear.
The mentors themselves also have a mental health diagnosis. McFeeder is bipolar. Making dozens of calls each day to people in need can sometimes take a toll on her. But, she says, they also allow her to be part of a solution.
It has given me a purpose and a reason to get up in the morning and to be able to access life, even though it's limited.
During these difficult times, a simple phone call can sometimes brighten the day for both people on the line.
That was Erica Mahoney reporting from Monterey County. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.